next session number 18443, Reel 1.
Colonel Shipster, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born at St Leonard's-on-Sea in Sussex.
Which year?
1922.
Can you tell me how and when you first came to join the Middlesex Regiment, please?
I joined the Middlesex Regiment very soon after the end of World War II on returning from Burma to England in the late summer of 1945.
Which regiment had you been in before the Middlesex?
I'd been in the 2nd Battalion of the Punjab Regiment.
Why had you transferred from the Punjab to the Middlesex?
Well, I always wanted to be a regular soldier, and it was not possible, although I would very much like to have done so if it was possible, to join the Indian Army. So that avenue having been closed to me, I applied for a regular commission in the British Army and attended a selection board in Calcutta in 1944, which I passed, and was then later given a commission in the Middlesex Regiment.
How did it suit you to be in the Middlesex rather than some other British regiment?
Well, I had a choice of regiments, and the Middlesex was one of my particular choices.
Had you had any family connection with Middlesex?
Strange to say, my father was a regular soldier, but he was in the Royal Armoured Corps, or Royal Tank Regiment, as it was originally called. But he was not an infantryman, and the answer to your question is that I had no family connection to any British infantry regiment.
Now, I think when you got called to Korea in 1950, you were serving in Hong Kong.
Correct. That's so.
Can you tell me how you received the news about going to Korea, please?
Well, the news really came right out of the blue. My commanding officer, Colonel Andrew Mann, summoned all the officers to a meeting and gave the news straight out that we were to move to Korea in various stages. I myself was to go with the advance party and to leave in approximately 72 hours' time.
Had you been following the political and military situation in Korea?
Very closely, particularly as certain American reinforcements, naval reinforcements, were going out to Korea and harbouring in Hong Kong en route. So we saw the odd aircraft carrier and the odd cruiser coming our way.
Had you anticipated that Britain would be pulled into the war?
I don't think any of us had anticipated that Britain would enter the war. The general feeling in England at that time was, let's, for God's sake, keep out of it. And it didn't have the support of the British government. It was only later, under pressure from the American president, that Britain agreed to send a token force, and we were to be a part of that token force.
Had you shared those feelings of, for goodness sake, let's keep out of it?
No, not particularly. I was a professional soldier and I found life in Hong Kong fairly dull. And although my wife had just recently arrived and with a small child, I obviously wanted to stay in Hong Kong on the one hand, and on the other, I was quite interested in taking a look at Korea.
In Hong Kong, in August 1950, what had been your specific job in the battalion?
My specific job in the battalion was second in command of a rifle company. I had previous to that, for most of the latter part of World War II, been a company commander in the Indian Army in action against Japanese, but perforce had dropped in rank on joining a British unit.
What rank did you hold in August 1950?
Captain.
And what company were you second in command of?
I was second in command of B Company.
What was the composition of B Company? Was it regulars or national service?
And I often look back on these times as to my initial impression was that it was about 50% conscripts and 50% regular, but I'm told I'm wrong in that. And the composition was more correctly about 70% national service, conscript, and 30% only regular.
How did you find the national servicemen in their attitude and performance?
I found it very good. I have not been one of these people who complained about national service soldiers. They accepted their lot, realized they got to serve, and did so with good humor.
Were most of B Company from Middlesex and thereabouts, or did they come from all over?
I don't know what you mean by all over, but they were certainly in the main Londoners. South East London, Central London, traditionally the Middlesex recruited from the East End of London, but as the years went by, the recruiting area was enlarged.
Can you tell me about leaving Hong Kong and going to Korea, please?
Well, I left Hong Kong in a terrible hurry, trying to sort things out with my own family, who were living in one room in a Chinese-run hotel in far from ideal circumstances. And I remember asking my colonel, Colonel Andrew Mann, whether or not we would be possibly going into action fairly soon or going to merely show the flag in Japan for propaganda purposes, i.e. that British troops were on the way, etc., etc. And I remember asking him if it would be in order for me to take my golf clubs and my tennis racket. And he said, by all means, John, take your golf clubs and tennis racket. And I departed from the airfield armed with my golf clubs and tennis racket. It all sounds slightly blimpish, doesn't it?
Not really. Did you go by yourself?
No, there was a small group that flew out to, I think the name of the air base was Itazuki Air Base in Japan, where we stayed overnight. And the next morning, instead of remaining on Honshu Island, the main island of Japan, which I thought was going to be the case, we flew to Daegu.
What happened there?
Was termed, I believe, the Nakdong Bridgehead. I got out of the plane on arrival, and much to my amazement found the airfield was under shell fire. I was then carrying my golf clubs and tennis rackets, and I remember a large black Negro sergeant came along and said, we've got a ripe lot of Charlies here, or words to that effect. That's not Americanese, it's a British interpretation of it. I wasn't ashamed, but I just threw them in a ditch and I never saw them again. After the war, I went back to Hong Kong and my wife asked me about my tennis racket and golf clubs. I said I'd thrown them away in Daegu. We were then, like most army officers, hard up, and I decided to put in a claim on insurance. 5 weeks later, I got a letter back from, I think it was the managing director of the insurance company, who said, we can't believe that there'll be any further claims like yours. And I've had a meeting with my brother insurers here, and we've decided not to pay you what you demanded, but we've decided to pay you double in view of the hardships you've had to put up with.
Which insurance company was this?
Sorry?
Which insurance company
was this? Are you trying to insure with insurance? I can't remember. My wife tells me it was the mutual insurance company. But I can't remember.
Sounds a good lot to be with. What happened to you next after you'd thrown your sports equipment away?
Well, we went and had an evening meal, and I remember being very surprised going down a pathway and through an archway which was inscribed with big letters above the archway with the great mortal words, "The greatest fightingest pilots in the world go down this chow line." Having had supper of some sort, we repaired to the officers' mess, where, much to our surprise, there were a number of American ladies. Some of them may have been wives of fighter pilots or bombing pilots or whatever it was. And I remember the evening was spent in great jollity with the American women asking and saying, "Gee, what do they wear under their skirts?"
This is the Argyles.
Yes.
It doesn't sound as though there was a very tense atmosphere then.
Not at all tense. It's one of the strange things about war. You don't find people tense in the front line usually. You find them tenser a wee bit further back. You often find the fighting elements, those that are flying aircraft, for example, and taking off the next day on missions, quite relaxed, or if they're not inwardly relaxed, they outwardly appear relaxed. It's part of the business of those of us who are in the front elements to adapt this sort of pose.
What kind of work were you and the rest of the party having to carry out as the advance party?
I'm hesitating because I can't remember being asked a single question of any importance. I remember just acting like an automaton, and instead of remaining in Japan, finding myself on a plane bound for Taegu, and our work really began when we disembarked at Taegu on this airfield under shell fire, and we had to take up the responsibilities and the needs of establishing ourselves in a strange country and getting organized and receiving the troops who formed the main party of our battalion and came by sea.
What were the main problems that you were having to face at that time?
I think really the main problem was to try and find out with any certainty, watertight information as to what was going on. There was a general air of chaos, general air of uncertainty. The North Koreans, who were the aggressors at this stage of the war, had come right down, approaching the southern tip of Korea, and the Americans had suffered serious losses, both in morale and in equipment, and information was very ragged.
What do you remember happening to you next, after having got your chow?
Well, I remember that I went from Taegu, which is a bit further north from Pusan, and going down to Pusan to meet the main body of the battalion, who arrived on an aircraft carrier, the name of which I can't remember.
What happened when you met the rest of the battalion?
Well, we were just meeting old friends again. We formed up into our respective platoons, companies, We were briefed by Americans and rebriefed by Americans. We suffered the same problems that I'd had initially at Taegu, lack of information, lack of very dramatic descriptions given to us about what was going on. I remember one American Marine colonel going up to Colonel Andrew Mann, and Andrew Mann asking him what's going on up there. The correct terminology isn't, by the way, what's going on up there. It's to say, God damn man, can you tell me what's cooking up there? Anyway, the reply that the gallant colonel got was, we're hitting it out punch for punch up there. All this lingo was slightly alien to our North London Cockneys, Londoners. We didn't quite know what to make of it.
Were there any problems for the battalion in getting themselves organized to go up to the front?
Tremendous problems. It needed a lot of ingenuity, and it needed a lot of warm-heartedness and generosity on the part of Americans to provide us with what we lacked. In the big sense, we had no guns, we had no tanks, we had very limited transport. We, in fact, were supplied by the Americans in all respects with our food and so on, rations. Our ammunition, of course, we brought with us because of the difference of caliber of the weapon, of the iron weapons and Americans. So we couldn't actually rely on Americans to provide that for us. Medical supplies, we had our own doctor, but we didn't have anything further to back us up than that, and we were reliant on American surgical and medical teams.
So you found the Americans very cooperative?
Can't speak too highly about them.
Can you tell me about when you and the battalion went into the front line, please, for the first time?
Well, I remember having slight doubts as regards myself, because I had been in Burma as a company commander, and I'd been wounded 3 times, and I'd served with Indian troops. And I'd found it quite difficult with Indian troops just to keep up with them and run. I found them extremely fine soldiers and extremely brave, and I wondered what being with British soldiers would be like. I can't speak too highly of them. I found that the moment we came under fire, which we did actually almost from day one, that it was just like being back in Burma again. My doubts left me completely.
So it was just the same as serving with Indian troops?
Well, I can't say it was just the same, because we weren't eating rice and dal, and we weren't speaking Hindustani. There are various cultural differences, but I know, take the point of your question, very similar.
What kind of terrain did you go into, first of all? What kind of positions and terrain did you go into?
We took our positions on the down on the river, and I'm trying to think of the name of the river.
Was it the Naktong?
The Naktong.
Naktong?
That's right. It was on the Naktong River. It was hilly terrain, and somewhat difficult to operate in. I'm trying to think about adding anything to that, but I will mention the first major incident that occurred, that the Argylls who were with us had occupied a strong, what was thought to be a strongly held position held by the North Koreans, when American aircraft came over, and there was some mess up about the use of identification panels. We were issued with air identification panels, which were supposed to be laid out in the form of a code letter or code. And the identification system went wrong, and the American aircraft mistook the two companies of the Argyles as being North Koreans, and they were bombed with napalm. I was a witness to this at very close quarters, and I think, talking from memory, that their total casualties were about 120 killed and or badly burnt. But like most calamities in war, the aftermath is never quite what it seems it was going to be at the time. What seemed a total disaster soon slowly rescinded, and the total number of seriously casualty of burnt soldiers was considerably reduced. The battalion went on to fight throughout the remaining period that they were in Korea with great gallantry and cohesion.
You saw that incident at close quarters?
Yes, I did. The second in command was with the two companies. His name was Kenny Muir, and he was awarded a Victoria Cross for his gallantry.
How did you come to be so near to the incident yourself?
Well, when we're talking about nearness, I suppose that as the crow flies, it was probably about a mile away.
But you realised what had happened.
And they were on the high ground. And I was down astride a road leading forward into our area of occupation. So it was quite easy to see it, literally, as if it was before one's very eyes.
What impression at this time did you get of the fighting capabilities of the enemy?
Well, my impressions of the enemy were based on two things. First and foremost, that they had been successful and that they had crossed the 38th parallel some 3 months previously and had knocked the Americans backwards towards their own baseline, so to speak, at Busan. And this must engender some respect in those of us who knew the terrain or seen what it was like, that they must have been good, reasonably good fighters. And that my impression was that they were a redoubtable enemy. My views changed much later when the tide turned. But at that particular time, at which you asked me, the question, I was rather wary of them.
When you went into the front line, did you then resume your role as second in command of B Company?
I remained with B Company for about a period of 7 or 8 weeks when I took over command of C Company, when the C Company commander was injured by an American tank which drove backwards and took his leg off.
And when you first went into the line with B Company, what can you remember the specific role that B Company played in the first few days?
We were merely seizing high ground to cover the Nakdong River, and I don't think there was any general plan for an advance or anything of that sort. We suffered a number of casualties, we killed a number of North Koreans, and in general, we were quite pleased with ourselves for having got bloodied and not suffered very much. And our wariness of the enemy from that point on, I think, became less pronounced.
Did the setback for the Argyles in being bombed affect morale in the Middlesex Battalion?
I don't remember it directly affecting our morale, except that we were certainly rather uneasy about American air support in the immediate future as to whether the same sort of dreadful mistake could reoccur.
Can you tell me about your memories about the push north, please?
The
push north from the Nakdong, the advance northwards?
Well, the advance northward was a strange affair. We were very much in the dark as to what was happening. We were under nightly pressure on various units of the North Korean army. And then we heard the brilliant news on the radio that General MacArthur had carried out a combined operations landing at a place called Incheon, which was just to the west of Seoul. And I've forgotten how many divisions were landed there, but I imagine that, or remember that there must have been at least two. And therefore, the North Korean army operating in the south was virtually cut off from its escape routes going north from Seoul. And from that point on, the South Korean army began to disintegrate. Disintegrate in the so far that they broke up into small parties, threw away their uniforms, donned civilian, God knows what sort of clothing it was, but donned civilian white clothing, and were not recognizable by soldiers in any way, and made their way either across the paddy fields or on roads.
This is the North Koreans.
Yeah, North Koreans.
As you advanced northwards, did you see much of the plight of the civilians?
Very much so. It was a distressing sight. The South Korean nation seemed almost everywhere to be in flight. Firstly, fleeing from the North Koreans, going southwards, and then with the advance of the American army towards Seoul, in some cases fleeing from the Americans, not out of fear of them, but really just not quite knowing where to go at all.
Did they?
Pathetic lines of civilians, women, children, carts drawn by bullocks, lumbering along the road, and sad to say, sometimes quite ruthlessly pushed off the road by the American mechanized columns going northwards.
Did the soldiers do anything for the civilians in the way of help?
I think that certainly as regards British soldiers, I think we've always had a good reputation, I like to think so, of kindliness to civilians. And I know of many instances where soldiers would stop their own vehicles and get out and help civilians either to get a bullock cart on the road again or help retrieve somebody that was lost. So I think that answers your question.
How did the army authorities view this kind of delay in helping civilians?
It's all a question of common sense. You can't prejudice your own operations to always help civilians, but whenever possible, it's a laudable thing to do, because after all, you're fighting in their country, and if you can get the civilians on your side and not create animosity, you've won a particularly useful trick. Analogy to playing bridge.
Do any specific incidents occur to you in your memory about that advance north that happened?